No, it's only that. It's on the website. I was counting on the website. It should be there. Yeah, this is fine. Okay, this is the start of the agenda, and I just forgot the name again. It's giving technical. Jas van Opry is the technical assistant and the scribe is Gas in this time. That way. So, which is provided nicely by the MCC. And everybody, of course, has seen the agenda and was just wondering whether at this. I don't have changes from my part, but that's the part for tomorrow, but. It's still all there, and I don't know whether anybody has additions or whatever. If not, we'll just go directly to point B, which is the server migration documents, meneer Reeds. I saw Jim just 5 seconds ago. Do you have anything to tell about that? It's the old action items, and do you want to add anything any more than you put on the list, or?
Thank you.
That's my other co-conspirator, part of the DNS working group chairs.
Yes.
And the other one sitting here, Peter Koch. So, I actually call ourselves the DNS cabal, but that's an internal name.
As you might remember, there's been an action item on me for far too many Write meetings to update the document that Fernando produced at several Write meetings ago. We did have an attempt to have a small working party to try and refine that document, and it sort of petered out and never went anywhere. So, a couple of weeks ago, Joao saying there were extensive comments made. Well, I apologise, Joao. Okay. They've obviously slipped my mind. The result of that is there's been an updated copy of the document which I posted to the list a few weeks ago. There were one or two comments from Jarle on the text that was there, but there's been no other comments, as far as I'm aware, on the working group list as of yet. So what I would like to suggest is that we leave this for another couple of weeks in case you all haven't had a chance to review the document in detail yet or comment on Jarle's comments. If you have any suggestions or updated text for the document, please post them to the list, and I still hold the token for producing this document in its final version since I've got the original source that was used to produce it. So I will then take all those comments together as and when they're finished. I think you can rely on the co-chairs to agree when we've got pretty much a final version of that document. We'll then pass it to the list for final comment and review, and if we're all happy with that, we can then have it published as a Write document. Does that seem like a reasonable way forward for everybody?
I will take that as yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Well, the other axiom I think lying around is for, by the other coach, yeah? Mr. Koch.
What a bad sign. Can we have the handful of slides that are...
The handful of slides are... Yeah. Whatever. Tools, slideshow.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. So this is about the outstanding update to RIPE 203. An action item that has been upon me like 2 years now, for 2 years now. So it should be really ripe by now. Anyway, as I said on the mailing list, there was no real good excuse for waiting so long. So please accept my apologies. I sent an update and a diff to the mailing list this morning, and I'm going to summarize or trying to summarize this on the slides here. For those of you who are probably not aware, and since that is an update to an update that was proposed to a document that at the time we tried the first update was already 6 years old, I thought I might summarize what the document is about in the first place. So this RIPE 203 is a rather short advisory document aiming at recommending certain values for the DNS SOA record and the various fields that are in there. It particularly aims at small and stable zones, because the observation at that time, and as far as I am concerned still today, but you might correct me, the observation was that the majority of zones is actually fitting that pattern. That is, it's small, very few labels in there, and is rather stable and once set up, not touched much often. So one of the basic ideas in that recommendation was to have fixed values instead of ranges. There are some other documents giving recommendations for filling in these values, and they say, okay, you can like have the refresh value from like 1 hour to 2 days and so on and so forth. Which is rather flexible and can cover multiple cases of application, but at the same time opens the opportunity that someone with, say, little DNS experience for who these documents usually are, makes some unfortunate choices in combining different values, like picking a low value for the one field and a not really optimized large value for another, and so on and so forth. So to limit these opportunities, the recommendation document gives fixed values without claiming that these are the only ones, but the set that is proposed there should work for the majority of the cases addressed here. And again, less argument, that was an input we received from a couple of ISPs who actually used this stuff and were rather happy that there were no value ranges given, but they could just point their customers to a document saying, okay, you fill in this and this and that, and you're done with it. And there was no argument about, oh, could it be better to have a shorter value here and a longer there? So it's a couple of years later, and the DNS world has changed and had changed 2 years ago when I started to update this the first time. Anyway, so Notify was already deployed at that time a bit. We didn't really have wide usage of dynamic update. Negative caching was already specified and was available in the software, but probably not the predominant use of that particular field of the SOA record. Okay, and some other techniques were less common. And wow, there was no DNSSEC 8 years ago. That makes a difference.
6 months.
Sure. Changes in the draft that I circulated this morning. First of all, I just renamed the stuff from minimum TTL to negative TTL, but that's only a side issue. The main point is that the original value was 2 days, because at that time it worked as a or acted as a default TTL for the whole zone. And since it's a negative TTL, the suggestion is to just stick that to 1 hour. Then RFC 3208 introduced this special $TTL directive to have a default TTL, and my suggestion from this morning was to stick that to one day. And there's an additional remark added, because there was also some feedback that people said, oh, you know, I tried to register a domain and I filled in values that didn't really follow RIPE 203 because I had a different application scenario, and I was refused this registration because someone pointed me back to 203 and said, thou shalt use these values. And so there's a warning remark in the draft now that says, okay, this is might be fine defaults, but they should not be blindly applied. Open questions, collecting the feedback that was gathered up until the first update attempts, people said, oh, the explanation of mname is probably a bit out of date or a bit confusing. I'd like to receive feedback about the text as it stands now. Second question, should we already care about DNSSEC? Would the expire value seriously need an adjustment, like being 41 days right now, I guess 1,000 hours, the usual way one did that back at that time? Is it really necessary right now to change that and limit the value to like 4 weeks to synchronize it with signature lifetimes, for example? Does the working group feel the need that there should be even more explanations or more in-depth explanations while maintaining the goal that this should be a really short document so the target audience is actually going to read it? And then finally, the question that should be posed first, of course, is the target audience clear enough and does it still exist? So these small and stable zones, are they really used or maintained today by persons we try to address here? That is people with little DNS experience that appreciate strong guidance. That's it from me. Any feedback instantly or?
Out of Qualcomm, RIPE NCC, I'm not speaking for the RIPE NCC. It's been 2 years, but I was actually thinking about a project that I did when at the RIPE NCC.
No, it wasn't.
So that was.
Remember the document. The document is in this state, like for 2 years.
And yeah, exactly. So this is a mind warp. But let me remind you that the kind guys of the RIPE NCC had a project where they did the reverse the del checker. And there are some values recommended also in the del checker. It might be good to have a look at what's in there and see if that needs to be in sync or out of sync. So there's some recommendations coded in there that have to do with this as well, like negative TTL.
Yeah, okay, absolutely makes sense. My vague recollection was that they were referring to 203 already, but that's...
Not for negative TTL, for instance.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Alex Meyerhofer, a short comment. What I've seen a couple of times is that people fail to properly escape the dot when it's used in the user part of the email address. So that might be worse when it's used in the mname field.
Yeah, the recommendation in the document that I did not change because I think it's still reasonable is to explicitly set up a new account following RFC 2142 and explicitly support an email address hostmaster at some domain. So you get away with personal email addresses, you get away with dots in email addresses, and you have a role mailbox so that several people can have a look at that. Thank you.
Jano Žako, 3C, Hungary. I would have a short question about mname because you mentioned it here. Is it safe to always assume that mname should be reachable over the internet or not? Because that's supposed to be the master primary, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
But is there a recommendation to have it accessible over internet or not?
The document is absolutely silent about that on purpose. Because at that time, I guess there were at least two schools of thought. One claiming that there should be no other server named in mname, or there shouldn't be a server named in mname that isn't already present in the NSRR set, and the other school of thought claiming the opposite, which would be interesting to know what the third school of thought is. But anyway, so my, yeah, personally, I think the first requirement is probably not too necessary. Do you think the document should be more explicit about that?
Yes. Well, actually, I would very much appreciate if we could reach consensus on the fact that it should be reachable. And if not, then it should be probably stated so.
Okay, that would mean that we add some text to the extent of the purpose of the mName field, which is for dynamic update and notify. And well, since this aims at small and stable zones, dynamic update is probably out of consideration, and notify is a matter between the maintainer of the primary and the secondaries, and we could get away with that probably. Okay, yeah. But that's, I appreciate the comment. We should discuss that part on the list so we get away with that ambiguity.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, just some quick questions, because the document itself was not on the agenda, and I'm afraid we can spend an hour on it. So most discussions I would prefer to have on the mailing list. But okay. Go ahead, anyway.
Okay,
you might want to cut the queue.
Yes, yes, and the queue after Joe.
Antoine Vuren, SIDN. I would like to back up Alexander's comment about the R name. I think the Hostmaster suggestion is not a solution. I've seen software out in the wild that what it basically does is it takes addresses out of Whois and puts them into the R name field without escaping the first dot in the username. So since this is a document for people who don't really read all the RFCs, they probably don't know how to escape a dot in the user part of an email address. So I would say just put a line in there, escape it.
Yeah, I again appreciate the comment. I'd like to learn more about this claim that software grabs stuff. Please send info to the list. Roy.
Dear Peter, hi, my name is
Roy. Which misspelling did I do?
My name is Roy Arends. I work for Nominet. I've come across the following a few times in my DNS work. Negative TTL doesn't mean that you can put a dash before a number. It also doesn't mean that your question or the response is cached before you actually ask it. So.
I would appreciate that. Well, actually, I can't respond to that, right? I'm so sorry.
It's Joe Apley here from Affilias. Just a very brief comment. I think there is a third school of thought on the M name, which is that if the master server, the authority server operators agree that they want to use explicit notify lists and don't want to look up clues for notify in the SOARR, and if the zone in question will never ever accept dynamic updates, then having an absent M name in the form of a single dot is legitimate. And I've certainly used that, and I haven't seen any ill effects.
Yeah, I am a bit afraid of the protocol police here, but thanks for the input, and I'll hope we have that on file.
Okay, thank you, Peter.
I guess I won't wait another 2 years for incorporating these comments. No, I'm not going to promise, and circulate an update draft version. So we can go to some kind of last call or whatever soon after the meeting. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I forgot to mention that this all the audio is recorded. So in case people have problems with that, they should be aware of it anyway. And the next is the update from the RIPE MCC, which was by André Robertchevsky. He's standing in for, as you know, Brett left RIPE MCC, and André is taking the honors this time and yeah. For telling us what is happening in the MCC with DNS.
Right. Good afternoon, my name is Andrei Rybachevsky. I'm the CTO of the Ripen CC, and I'm presenting this update because all the credits and actually all the work that is done goes to the group that I will introduce shortly. But before, what I want to tell you in this update briefly about our reverse DNS, some statistics, and what happened with slash 16 policy that was implemented actually. Key root update, lameness checking. We completed the first phase of the project, and I will talk bit about first statistics that we gathered. Secondary service for CC TLDs, and a couple of words about our future plans. So the DNS group, and that's the DNS group at the Ripen CC that does all the work. As DNS group manager, and this position currently is vacant. I think we are planning to wrap this up this week and make a decision very soon. So you should know the new manager quite soon. Anand, who is in this room, he's responsible for K and IS-112. Shurd, he is the master of our auth, DNS service, and DNSSEC. And the general help mail is available. It's ticketized, so if you have any problems with our DNS, please send a ticket, and we'll open a ticket here. Reverse DNS, well, it's business as usual. It shows a normal pattern of day and night in the European zone. With regards to NS.Ripe.net as a secondary server for reverse delegation, there was a policy proposal actually pointing that there is an inconsistency between how this is dictated in IPv6 and IPv4. And the proposal was made at RIPE54, which actually suggested that including NS.RIPE.NET as a secondary server for those delegations is not mandatory, it's optional. And what group agreed to this proposal, and it was implemented in September. So I don't think it made any significant impact because the force of tradition, but people, we don't have any more complaints that people say, why should they include NS.RIPE.NET in this delegation? Some DNS statistics, which this group asked RIPE-NCC to report periodically, and this is current statistics and comparison to what we had at RIPE 54. And strangely enough, you can see that while the amount of delegations has increased, that increase in DS records, which actually indicates secure delegation, didn't increase that much. Well, if just a simple chart with regards to DS record distribution, as you can see, well, the numbers are still low. It's about 32 DS records, and that's the maximum, and that's in 1989 in our ARPA zone. If you look at the size of the zone at the same time, well, it shows a slightly different pattern, so there is no real correlation between the size of the zone and number of DS records, which is probably not very surprising. Key root update. We are actually polishing and looking in at our infrastructure, making more resilient and more stable. Even more stable, I would say, because I think it was very stable for the last years. Rolling out new OS, the OS of a choice is CentOS at the RIPE-NCC, and we are rolling this OS on all K-root nodes. Ongoing hardware and support upgrades, and production IPv6 support. So actually, K is available on IPv6, and we looked at different aspects of this, and now we can say that we have deployed production IPv6 support for K, and should quad A record appear in the root zone and the root server system one day, then K is ready to serve. And this is how K looks from the V6 world, and this is what DNSMon shows. We're now able to monitor K and other root servers from DNSMon. Green is good, by the way. lameness checking project. Well, we have completed the first phase of this project, and we've done two runs. We, as was stated in the proposal, we do monthly runs, and if the survey is behaving lame 5 times in 10 days, we declare this server lane. And at this phase, we decide not to send notifications, but rather see how many notifications we would send if we decide to do that. So what the prototype shows, it shows actually 6.5% of lameness on average. While there is a big diversity, if you look at the zones, it is the lowest lameness is less than 1% for some of the zone and up to 16% in some other zones. I haven't done real research seeing how you know the age of this zone correlates with the lameness, but yeah, we can do that later. So we are prepared to send notifications to 4,000 plus contacts. And if you think it's a good idea, actually the next step, we plan to implement that. And at each run, send those notifications, but not just you are lame, but probably supplying some recommendations how you can fix those things. Secondary service for CCTLDs. Just a bit of background. As you all know, we have a long history of offering secondary DNS service for two CCTLDs. This is provided on best effort basis. And we are doing this since early 90s. I think community, and we also realize that conditions have changed. And there is a potential, the danger of potential competition with the members. Still, and that what we heard as well, that stability of DNS of paramount importance. So responding to those concerns, we asked five well-established CCTLD operators to consider planning and moving away from the RIPE NCC. So we discussed this with each individual operator, and all five have migrated. And I would like to thank all five CCTLDs for their cooperation and understanding of community concerns. Thank you. So, well, that's how it looked like, and there are only three on this graph because AT&T, we didn't host them on our secondary service, but we provide part of our infrastructure. And look at the numbers. Now, that's what we have. It's 10 times less. So here's my question. Do we want to continue this dialogue and actually take the next five or three, or we think that for the time being it's okay? I think we can demonstrate those pictures and people can decide for themselves. And if they're willing to move away from the NS.RIPE.NET, NSSEC.RIPE.NET, then we can discuss their migration plan and help them with it.
Jim Reid, wearing no hats. I think the sentiment that was expressed before about this from the competition point of view, Andrew, was to have a gradual phased withdrawal from this DNS hosting service, except in the case of deserving causes. And I think the mindset that we all had was with people like, say, for example, in Africa or other parts of the world that have not got very good infrastructure. And I think everyone would obviously support that kind of initiative, but I would have expected that some of the other ones that are still up there are probably registries that could go out and get that service elsewhere, and they really don't need to get this from the NCC. So I would ask you to consider continuing this dialogue with these guys. If they can give reasonable expectations about why they can't move elsewhere, then obviously we've got to consider the stability aspect of this. But if the guys can move, I think we should encourage them to move. Personal opinion.
Thank you, Jim. Fair enough. Any other comments? Okay, then we'll continue this dialogue, I think. Fair enough. Thank you. And future plans. So, well, we continue hardware upgrades and support upgrades. We plan to finalize lameness checking, introducing second phase, implement notifications, and continue running and reporting. And as we go, the statistics, the collection should become more interesting. And we plan to implement DNSSEC in the ENUM T0 zone E164 ARPA. And there will be a separate presentation at ENUM working group on Thursday. And that basically concludes my presentation. If you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Okay. Thank you, Emily. There's a question popping up.
Hello, my name is Sarah. I'm from fccndns.pt. I just have one question in the DNSSEC statistics. I noticed that the sign zones from the RIPE 54 to this RIPE had decreased. Do you have any explanation for that?
Actually, what happened is that we at RIPE 54 we counted some test zones that we assigned for DNSSEC, and we have cleaned them up. So those are not all operational zones. It's not that we design. Okay. Is it a good word? Design the zones. No.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Glasses on. The next on the agenda is Antoine Verschuur giving an update about what's happening in the various fields of DNS, like the IETF DNS groups and similar stuff. And
yeah. Good afternoon. My name is Antoine Verschuur, and I'll try to give you a brief update of what happens in the field of DNS at the IETF since the last RIPE meeting. If you want to go to details yourself about what happens at the IETF, these are the addresses you can look at. The tool site of the IETF, you'll find all the documents and the status of the documents, the relevant mailing list and Jabber rooms and everything you need to know. I'll start with the DNS Extensions Working Group. Since the last RIPE meeting, the DNS Extensions Working Group is a dormant working group. As you might know, DNS Extensions Working Group is has almost done its work, and when a working group normally has done its work in the IETF, it is closed down. The DNS Extensions Working Group still has some things to do, but there's no new work going there. So what dormant really means is there's not a physical meeting. There was no physical meeting in Chicago for the DNS Extensions Working Group. But the mailing list is still active, and there's still some documents that need to finish. So the first document that the DNS Extensions Working Group has done is NS Server ID, which basically means that this is a protocol extensions where from a response from a server from an Anycast cloud, you want to know which instance of an Anycast cloud this response is coming from. And this is basically an extension where a name server operator, by looking at the response, can say, okay, it's this server in our cloud that is giving this response for debugging reasons. This has been done, it's been approved, and it's RFC 5001. Another document is the NSEC 3 record. I wrote these slides last Wednesday, I must say, because there has been quite some discussion on this in the last week. Everybody thought this was a done deal. NSEC 3 is a resource record to be used in DNSSEC where you prevent zone enumeration and you provide authenticated denial of existence in DNSSEC. It has been reviewed by the ISG already, but they wanted some clarification, so a new version of the document came out, and then suddenly there is a lot of discussion going on about this document. I would say it was almost there. That was my comment last week. I don't know where it is at this moment. Other things still on the plate of the DNS Extensions Working Group are the 2929BIS, which is basically considerations for DNS parameter assignment by IANA. It's at ISG processing, so that's almost done. And the two active drafts are an update to the DNAME specification. I'll come to that later on in the presentation because there are some new use cases for DNAME, so a good specification of DNAME might be appropriate. And the other one is forgery resilience, where, you know, the implementation of DNSSEC might still take a while, and there are lightweight measures that we can already take to prevent spoofing in the DNS, to make spoofing in the DNS a bit more harder than it is today. And these are the documents that are still open for discussion. So if you have any input, go to the mailing list and leave your comments. Then work for the DNS operations working group. I said earlier that the NURM server ID draft had been approved. It's now an RFC. The operations working group has made a requirement document for that, and of course you first make a requirement and then you do the implementation, so it will come as no surprise that this one has been approved before the other one, and it's now RFC 4892. Then another document that's almost done, reflectors are evil. This is about open recursive name servers. It's a recommendation on how to configure your name server to prevent it being used in reflector attacks for DDoS. This is recommended reading for network operators. A lot of stuff in DNS operating group regarding to the AS112 project. I presume everybody knows what the AS112 project is. There's some recommendations on default local zones that vendors should actually implement in when shipping a default configuration in a name server. And there's some background information on what AS112 is. And so the first one is really for vendors. The last one is recommended reading material for network operators. If you're going to do something with DNS on your network, read this. And you will know what AS111 will do. Active draft, a description of issues related to the packet size of DNS messages. Reverse mapping consideration, that's a document that's been there for quite some time and really doesn't speed up. And the other one is a quite new one, which is resolver priming, which basically says, well, okay, if you start up a resolver, what basic queries should it do? And it's not that it is a lot of magic, but it has never been written down before, so this is sort of like a gap in the DNS specification. Future work fields of DNS operations are name server requirements for name server configuration and management protocols, so basically setting up some sort of a protocol where you can configure your name servers. Or a protocol enhancement, or anyway, setting up requirements of what do we actually mean when we say, okay, we want to do easier DNS configuration and management. Some guidance on time to list for infrastructure zones, so what's an appropriate TTL for a TLD or a root zone, which basically says, well, okay, this is the most convenient TTL. And there is a request from the Enum working group saying about the deployment of EDNS0. So Enum has large nectar records in it. So probably if you're going to do something with Enum, your DNS infrastructure should support EDNS0. Then the Enum working group itself. There is of course a session of the Enum working group tomorrow. This is only what's related to DNS. There's a new draft out for a combined Enum and infrastructure Enum and user Enum pointer, which basically first suggested a new resource record to be used so that you can point from the user Enum tree to the infrastructure Enum tree. And this was considered not such a good idea, so now this pointer is going to be using DNAME. So that is why the revision of the DNAME draft is actually quite important. Last thing, is the DKIM working group in the IDF. This is something of interest perhaps for DNS people because they want to use DNS basically for having some sort of a authentication for email. Simply what they do is they put a public key in the DNS, they sign a message with a private key, and then the recipient can check if the mail was trusted by the domain that the other key was in. This is basically it. If you want to participate in the ITF, read the mailing list during the physical meetings, and there's a webcast and Jabber so that you don't have to be at the meeting yourself. But if you want to go to the next physical meeting, next one's in Vancouver in December, and in spring it's in Philadelphia, and hope to see some of you there. That's it. Any questions?
Thank you, Antoine. It's my private observation that actually Enum is producing a draft a week, but I've lost count. Anyway, the next bit on the agenda is actually as a placeholder, and
whether there are some leftover items from the plenary. It's basically whether or not there are discussions about presentations of the plenary. And this time there was not, at this plenary, not anything controversial, but Rüdiger has something to ask.
Yes, well, the agenda item doesn't say leftovers from which plenary. In this working group at Tallinn, we made some statement about the need for having the root zone signed and the impact of not having it. And that statement was transformed to an endorsement statement by the plenary, which is, well, okay, leftover. And unfortunately, we haven't heard anything reported back about that in any of the plenaries this time. So I would like to ask to get some of that leftover touched. I note further on that Richard Lamb reported in his technical presentation on DNSSEC implementation at IANA that, well, okay, it looked to me like the report was essentially everything is in place for implementation at IANA. It would be a little bit nicer to actually have the very explicit statement that this is the case or what's missing. If IANA doesn't want to give us any other additional comments and explanation.
Well, I take it this is a question. Ah, there is Mr. IANA.
How did I know I'd be asked questions here? I'm sorry, what did you want to know? Close. We actually, all the stuff that Richard's done is completed. Right now, the only thing that's holding us up is getting secondaries for the ARPA zones. There's some doodads with ARPA itself, but all the stuff that Richard is been working on is, as far as I'm aware, pretty much done.
Well, okay, David. Thanks a lot. Well, if you have to offer any additional information, that I'm not standing in your way. But actually, the question to you was kind of a second one. The first one, of course, is well, okay. What feedback did we get out of the nice statement that Axel sent out?
Actually, the letter was sent to ICANN basically, and the response was zero. I know there was some discussion, as far as I know. I know there was some discussion in San Juan during the open forum about the letter, but after that, I don't think anything happened. But maybe Axel.
No, I sent the letter off, and I got two comments that it was received and posted publicly. After that, I didn't hear anything.
It's so hard to get good help nowadays. I obviously cannot speak for for my management or ICANN's board. I will reiterate an interest in getting a response to the RIPE communique to my superiors.
Thank you for that. Well, I'm probably not a satisfying answer, but at least some answer. And
the best you could expect.
I won't comment anymore. But related to that was the other part what happened in Tallinn, and that is whether or not it would be of interest to have some DNSSEC key repository hosted at RIPE. And is the task force looking at that? And one of my two colleagues is going to address what happened in a meeting last Monday. And, note that I don't know anything about it due to too many hats.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, everybody. As Jaap said, there was quite a considerable discussion about the issue of having some kind of trusted key repository at the Tallinn meeting, and the working group was pretty much split down the middle about whether this was a good thing or a bad thing. And so we decided that a task force is a way to try and find out some way of accommodating these almost mutually exclusive positions and trying to figure out some kind of way forward that would make sense in a reasonable amount of time. So we established the DNSSEC Trust Anchor Repository Task Force. That's obviously far too long a name, so if anyone can think of a shorter acronym, I'd be very glad to hear it. So what have we done so far? Well, we have obviously we've got a mailing list and a website set up. Thank you very much to the NCC staff that helped get this thing done and help us with a little bit of drafting for the charter. Since the mailing list was established, we've had some discussions about some general principles, and most of that's focused on motherhood and apple pie statements, which should be fairly self-evident. In other words, that the Trust Anchor Repository, the TAR as we call it in the task force, it should be technology neutral. At the moment, something like DLV is one of the flavours of the month for being a trust anchor, but maybe something else might emerge in the future, or maybe someone's got some better ideas that have just not disclosed yet. So we don't want to have a trust anchor repository that's particularly focused on one specific type of verification technology or one particular scheme for doing that. The other obvious things you'd want from any kind of trust anchor repository would be to be operated by a trusted and impartial organisation. This is probably not the sort of thing you'd want to be hosted by some kind of commercial entity that might be in a position to grab or use its position to then dominate the use of the keys or changing signing and so on and stuff like that. So an organisation like, for example, the NCC or perhaps the IANA would be obvious types of places for this kind of thing could be hosted. We also had a very sort of brief discussion about things to do with performance metrics, and by that what we're trying to do is think about how can we assess the success or failure of the Trust Anchor Repository for some very, very loose definitions of those terms. I mean, what do we mean by success? Well, success probably means that the Trust Anchor Repository is no longer needed because the route's signed. Well, that's one definition of success. Another definition of success could be as well, we can't get the route signed, so therefore this Trust Anchor Repository acts as some kind of generalised, centralised workaround for that. So maybe that's success. So we have to think a little bit about that. And also another important component here is the issue of an exit strategy. And I think this is very appropriate considering all the discussions we've been having recently about IPv4 issues and IPv4 exhaustion concerns. Decisions that we made as a community 10, 15 years ago are maybe not relevant or appropriate today. And maybe if we go down this particular path, we need to have some way of making sure we can unwind things or at least put this thing to bed if it turns out to be going in the wrong direction or we feel it's no longer needed. And of course, then we have to make an assessment about how we can figure out how something is no longer needed. Aside from our mailing list discussions, we had a physical meeting on Monday morning, which was popped up in the agenda. And we actually had a lot of people in the back of the room, in the grand ballroom across the hallway there. And so a lot of people couldn't really track what was going on, or people were saying to me afterwards they couldn't follow the conversation. And I think people were under the wrong impression that this was a sort of public discussion type thing. Well, the intention was for the task force members to sit round in a circle and discuss things primarily amongst themselves. But if anyone wanted to observe, they were more than welcome to do that. But we weren't meaning to address an audience of a couple of hundred people sitting in a huge big ballroom. That was not the intention. So my apologies if people had the wrong impression about that. I'm delighted to say that Richard Lamb from IANA came along and gave us a sneak preview of the talk he gave in the plenary yesterday about the IANA testbed, and that was very helpful to some of the discussions that then took place in the task force. And thanks to Daniel for doing a little bit of coordination there to make that happen as well. So what we felt was, in some respects, that the work that IANA is doing just now could make this whole issue of a trust anchor repository completely irrelevant, because if IANA is already doing it, do we really need anybody else to be doing it? Because obviously, in some respects, IANA is the obvious home to do this kind of thing. They've got the relationships with TLD operators. They ultimately have their hands on the route, albeit it might be through DOC and all the rest of it. But that's the obvious place to do so. Yeah. And obviously, this would also help with the efforts to get the route signed, because if IANA is managing this process, they're much closer to all the ICANN policy people that want to discuss processes, issues, and things that surround that. But there's also a downside to this too, because IANA could potentially lead into all sorts of layer 9 problems. One of those particular issues is, of course, just ICANN is a very bureaucratic organisation, and sometimes it takes a long time to make decisions about things. We may also have concerns because some parts of the world might not be all that friendly or well disposed towards an ICANN, IANA stroke run route, and they may not be too happy about the idea of depositing their country's keys, their critical infrastructure, with what they consider to be a less than friendly government. And there was also some concerns raised about the perception or the look and feel of having an alternate route, because the system that IANA's proposing is we're going to set up a route cert, a zone that's been signed, and there'll be signed delegations underneath that on some other servers, and that could have the look and feel of some kind of alternate signed route, and that could be a little bit nasty. So we felt that it's probably a good idea to consider having an alternate approach to this, so that in the event that if, for example, the IANA scheme did run into difficulties, which are not likely to be technical or operational, perhaps more at a layer 9 or a layer 10 to do with political problems, there could be some alternate mechanism available for that. So we tried to focus back on really what was the issue that Teleton errored firmly dropped in the task force's lap in Tallinn. So we felt that this trusted anchor repository got to sort of reflect the DNS hierarchy, and Daniel gave a memorable turn of phrase which I asked him to remind me about and I've duly forgotten about, which was the idea is that DNS trust anchors should reflect the DNS delegation hierarchy in some respects. Did I get that right, Daniel? Trust hierarchy, DNS hierarchy. Thank you. There was also felt that perhaps in that respect we shouldn't publish the keys directly in DNS, and maybe we put them on some kind of secure website or something of that nature in an open publication format, maybe something that's XML-ish, or maybe it's something that's along the lines that the IETF has been talking about fairly recently. And then obviously they have some tools with that, so it'd be translated into metadata. So we now have to make some progress here. The recommendation from the task force was to ask the NCC to prepare a specification, and the task force would somehow oversee that work or coordinate that work or cooperate or work with the NCC in the preparation of that specification. So the outline proposal we have here is that we would ask the NCC to prepare this specification by the end of January. The task force would complete a review of that by a month later, end of February, and then it would go for public comment on the mailing list, and then with a view to having possible implementation by round about the time of Right 56 in May-ish, thereabouts. So from a process point of view, the way we'd like to proceed here is we'd like to ask for support or endorsement for this approach from the working group. So what I'm asking the working group here and now to do is, if they think this approach is sensible, if so, can we as a task force have the authority to proceed along those lines? And then, if that's the case, I've got a slot reserved in the ERAM Services Working Group under EOB to say we've asked the NCC to do this so there can be a little bit of discussion about the service dynamics and the NCC's activities there, and possibly that might even fall over into the NCC General Meeting later this afternoon. So that's all I have to say. I've got some time for questions, but I would ask if we could have some indication of whether they think this is the right way forward, and if we could get the support from that from the working group. Thank you.
Olaf Klokman and Nelnet Labs, now I get it right. The exact requirements, by agreeing on establishing this task force and this process, are we also agreeing on the requirements that we send the task force away with?
I'm not quite sure I would categorise it like that, Olaf. I think we have to find out what the requirements are, and I think the initial intention is to ask the NCT to help us capture those requirements and perhaps have the task force members refine them in some way. But this is not to be the be-all and end-all. Whatever is the ultimate set of requirements, it will come back to the working group for the working group to comment on.
That sounds good, yeah.
Yeah. I think Andrew's coming up.
Yes.
Andrew Rochevsky, RIPNCC. So, Jim, if I understand correctly, high-level requirements, they're still coming from the task force in form of this presentation, or should we expect another document coming from the task force to NCC so we can elaborate on those requirements and prepare a spec?
Right. I think there's obviously going to be dialogue between the task force members and the NCC, because obviously this has to be done. In fact, there are a couple of people from the NCC on the task force, and I expect Daniel's going to have a sort of key role in this activity. Not that I can speak for Daniel. What I would like to say is I think we're going to primarily ask the NCC to help produce the requirements document. We may have some bullet points or high-level abstract ideas about what we think should be in the requirements documents, things like performance metrics, things like an exit strategy. We just say, think about an exit strategy. Please come up with something in the requirements document that would outline what an exit strategy might look like. And that's then something the task force would refine and then come back and present to the working group. And now Daniel wants to speak.
I'm Daniel Kahnberg. I'm with Ananet Labs. there's two remarks I wanted to make. One is this idea that the trust hierarchy should be as closely mapped to the delegation hierarchy as possible. You used my words. That's right. But the guy who put this into my mind was this guy.
So okay.
He convinced me about this. So that's just to give credit. The other thing is, I think what I heard you say was you want some high level requirements. You don't want a sort of SLA. You said in the widest sense of the word, right? So I heard Andre say specs. So that's not what we're looking for. We're looking for some very general stuff and general measures about what would success be, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And I would think that we do that since we have a task force. I would expect that it would be an interactive process between the RIPE NCC and the task force to actually hammer out the details.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the approach here is that the task force is obviously going to be involved in the production of this thing, but we're probably hoping that the NCC can do the bulk of the heavy lifting. I think that's the best way to characterize
that's,
it.
That's understood.
Yeah.
The other remark is, I didn't hear you, I'm totally tired, I'm sorry, but I think what we also said on Monday is that the marching orders we would get as the NCC was also to work very closely with the IANA to see what kind of cooperation in this is possible and
whether
the IANA service could actually be it or not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Olaf?
Olaf Kolkman once again, still in Ananet Labs.
Are you sure about that?
I think so. A secret working group could be another option. What I'm not quite sure about, and you should go back to the list of high-level things, one of the requirement answers that we need to have, and that's why I was basically asking the question, is the proposed anchor repository, does it only contain entries just below the root, or does it go down the tree so that in absence of big TLDs not being signed, people can get a trust anchor? That's one of the requirements that you need to tease out. I have a preference for staying as high up in the tree as possible, but it's one of these things that that will become part of those requirements.
I'm well aware of the rat hole we could just about jump, the task force could jump into here. The initial tasks that was put on here was a specific focus on TLDs.
Good.
I actually would like to wrap up the discussion because we're running out of time, but the last question.
Ladislav, it is Emirates Telecommunication. We run currently .ae. My point was, I see these activities somehow contradicting what ICANN is doing, what Rich is doing, and what RIPE is start doing. So I think it's quite confusing, for the ordinary user, how these projects can be explained. My point was basically, if there is an activity of signing of the root, and in the same time the RIPE is trying to do something separate without that, how these things will, doesn't these things overlapping, aren't these things overlapping right now?
Well, your point's well made, Ladislav, but I don't think there's any intention here to have competing efforts. I think the whole object is to either be complementary or to assist or enabler. Some of the layer 9 things we alluded to earlier on is that it may be impractical for all sorts of reasons that are beyond the control of the IANA folks that there may be a requirement for somebody else to host this kind of trusted anchor. And in that case, maybe an organization like the NCC might be able to fill in the breach.
Because at the end, you know, you need the end users to participate
in But the whole point about this is, first of all, is to cooperate and work with the IANA effort and, in essence, enhance and strengthen their efforts, because I think that's really where we want to see this thing go.
So you're basically planning of publishing these DS records in IANA, or is there any agreement?
This is just far, far too low-level detail. There's nothing being gone into that level at the moment.
So for the people who want to participate, you know, there's
nothing to participate in at the moment, because we've not even teased out what the requirements are. We're trying to work...
There's a signed route already, right? You can participate in this.
No. No, there's not. No. No.
No.
That's an experimental thing.
It's experimental. I'm talking about experiment. I don't think you're talking about production. Are you talking about production?
Eventually, yes, but we're not talking about it. Not at this stage. And if it comes to production, it may well be it's the IANA thing. I think you're jumping way, way ahead of where we are in this process, Ladislav.
I'm trying for the normal user to start participating in it, because at the end you need somebody to participate in this, right?
Quite frankly, when there's something for normal users to know about and participate in, there'll be documents and things that will tell them how they can participate, how they can use this. But that's a long, long way from where we are right now.
So there is no participants at all right now?
Because there's nothing built, there's no infrastructure.
For me, it would be interesting, you know, if I can set up my caching name server pointing to the signed route and do this old hierarchy, I can reach, I don't know, SEO or whatever it is. Countries already signed, it would be interesting for me to operate this.
For the sake of time, can we probably have this discussion on another time? But what I would suggest is that you write up what the task force is doing on this moment, and maybe you.
And also the
part of
the task force mailing list is public. Anybody can see what's been posted to the list. The summaries of the notes of yesterday's meeting have been posted to the list already, so everybody can see what's going on there. But it's far, far too early to even think about using this for your evaluation or services, or even talk about production use.
No, I'm not talking about production. I never mentioned production.
Well, you did actually, but let's.
Not in this far.
I think we should have a discussion in the bar about this, Ladislav.
Hi, this is Ioan Rian, Autonomica. I wasn't there for the task group meeting. I wasn't on a plane. But I have to question why restricted this to TLD keys. I realize you said that was the charge.
We are not going to discuss it now. Please, discuss this with the task force. We're running out of time.
Okay.
Just very briefly, number one, when this comes to even experimental stuff, we'll have documentation that says what you can expect and what you can't expect. That's number one. Number two, there's absolutely no confusion, at least for what I think that we know. There's absolutely no confusion that the RIPE NCC will definitely stop any of these activities once the route is signed. So that one of the requirements will be that there's a clearly defined exit strategy for the event that the route gets signed. So no confusion about that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jim. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but we'll be late in the tea pass. But now it's the word to Karsten Stroman, and he's going to tell you everything you wanted to know about DNS and were too afraid to ask. And he just arrived here by car, and we haven't uploaded his slides yet.
No.
Thank you.
So my name is Carsten Stortmann. I'm from NMIS, and I would like to give you some information on how to do DNS without DNS server. And I've done some testing, some lab testing here, and I will tell you about my motivation in a few moments when the slides are up. Before I start, let me tell you, I'm not a member of any of these teams creating these protocols. I'm neither in favor or against this, so don't blame me.
It's your fault.
Thank you.
Who was that?
Tomatoes.
It's not DNS.
It's out of scope. Yeah, next.
So here we are. It is about doing DNS or DNS kind of services without a central DNS server. I will talk about multicast DNS, DNS service discovery, link local multicast name resolution and peer name resolution protocol. And what is my motivation to do that here? Is it out of scope or is it in scope? We are not in the business of doing ad hoc networks or peer-to-peer business, and these protocols are mostly used in that area, ad hoc networks and peer-to-peer business. But, and also I told you that, I'm not in there, or we are not in there. But what we do is we do DNS audits and we do DNS troubleshootings. We have customers that fight with DNS, and we want to know what new technologies are out there and how they can affect the old plain DNS in real life. And that might also be interesting for you, I think. So phase one, that is where I'm in today, is doing some research and lab testing. And phase two will be some real-world numbers that I might present next year. So let's start with multicast DNS. That is used to resolve names and services, actually, without a DNS server. And it uses port 5353. And it's doing that over multicast addresses. And these are the addresses, one for IP version 4, one for IP version 6. And the nice thing about multicast DNS is that it's using almost the same packet format. So if someone wants to play around with that, you can use existing tools. You can sniff with Wireshark or other DNS sniffer tools, and you can use actually dig to query multicast DNS. So in multicast DNS, we have three different types of queries. We have one-shot type of queries, that is like we have in normal DNS. We send out a query and we get a response. Then we have multiple responses, and that is quite typically that if we send out a query, we don't get an answer just from one machine. We might get answers from like 10 or hundreds of machines out there. So the program sending out the query must not terminate after receiving the first answer, but might wait a certain time to receive multiple answers. And then we have ongoing queries, that is where there is a direct connection between the application sending the query and all the other applications out there sending answers, waiting for updates. One-shot queries we can certainly do with dig if we want to test it out. For example, if we send a dig to port 5353 here in the network, targeted at the multicast address, and for example, we ask for underscore secure shell underscore TCP local, and then we ask for pointer records, and then we get answers back. We'll show you that later. Here, a little picture how multicast DNS works. Bob wants to connect with Bill, and we don't know the IP address. We don't know anything about Bill. We shout a multicast DNS request, multicast DNS request into the network that is received by all the machines that listen to that multicast address. And then, of course, Bill will send an answer, but that is also multicast, so all the others will also listen and will get this answer and will put that into their caches. So this is one important thing. is that if someone asks in multicast DNS and there's an answer sent, all the others will also listen and learn from that. But multicast DNS is built to prevent chattiness, so to prevent too much network traffic. There is a known answer list sent by every client that sends a request. So, for example, if my client requests all the secure shell login servers here in the room or here in the network, it can say, okay, please give me all _secure_shell_TCP, but I know already this and this and this and this guy. Please don't answer on that. So that can prevent a little bit of chattiness. And there is the truncation bit in the normal DNS package, which is reused here, to say a package is truncated and the known answer list is actually in the following package. So the end of the known answer list. So it's not used as in normal DNS where we switch to TCP. Instead, the truncation bit says, okay, this known answer list is not complete, wait for the next package and there's the next part, and so on and so forth. The known answer list is not authoritative, so also all other clients in the network listening on the same multicast address will see the answer list. They cannot take any entries from there and use that information. And there is an exponential backoff and non-constant query rate to make sure that not one machine is polluting the network too much. And the TTL is used, but different from normal DNS, where when the TTL is expired, the record is just removed from the cache. Here in multicast DNS, when an entry in a cache is being to be expired, then the machine with the cache will send, before it expires the record, sends another query for that record. And if there's still an answer, that record will be refreshed in the cache. If there's no answer, then the record will be expired from the cache. And because we have multicast answers, all the other clients will listen and fill their caches also with answers they see, but they haven't asked for. I'm not talking about security here. It would be too long. Importantly, multicast DNS cache is independent from the normal DNS cache, so that won't fill up our normal DNS cache here. And also we have built-in answer suppression, so if some client is preparing to send an answer, but it sees the same answer being sent from another client at the same time, it will not send its answer, because this information has already been sent to the network. So each machine or each service chooses a name, and in order to prevent naming collisions in the network, because there's no central DNS administrator that makes sure that all names are unique, the multicast DNS sends out a probe sending its own name, asking for record type any for that name that it has chosen. And it sends out three queries waiting 250 milliseconds in between. And if there's an answer on that same name, then it will choose another name, mostly pretending .1, .2, .3, or -1, -2, -3 to the name and start again. And because it can happen that two machines at the same time try to resolve the same name or to announce the same name, there's a tiebreaker algorithm in there making sure that the one that has the lexicographical later content, that is, if that's sorted, the record class, record type, and record data is lexicographically later, that wins. And if there's a naming collision, then the whole probing process begins from beginning with just a different name, appending .1 or -1, -2, and so on to the name. That is because if you see my machine in the network, you see Carsten's computer 3, because I have 3 Macs in my home, so this is number 3 I have. So if we have a name, or if a service has a name, or a machine has a name, it sends out a resource record containing all records this client wants to announce. So it can be multiple record types, can be pointer records, multiples of that for different services, with a special cache flush bit set. And the cache flash bit set says this is no authoritative answer, please forget everything you have heard about this name or service before. This information, this package is the ultimate truth. And if you want to remove deregister service or name from the network, then we send a response package. So not a query or something, just a response package, because without having first getting a request, we send a response with a TTL of 0. So every client listening to that will get that record and will, because it's time to lift 0, will delete then every cache entry from that. The multicast DNS is using the reserved namespace dot local. So everything in a multicast enabled operating system sent to something.local will be resolved using multicast DNS and not using classical DNS. Although on some operating systems you can configure a fallback to classical DNS. So if there's an annex domain on multicast DNS, you still try then normal DNS after that. So a multicast DNS package can be large, it can be up to 9K, and it's using UTF-8 Unicode names that can be quite confusing if you see that on the wire. Possible operational issues we can think of is that applications are sending multicast DNS queries to classical DNS servers. Or that applications, even worse, send multicast packages. Although they have the same package format, they have a different meaning on the flags, send that to classical DNS servers. And another problem, maybe the worst problem we see is that the .local classical DNS domain is hidden by multicast DNS, and we have quite a lot of customers that have Microsoft Active Directory deployed and they use .local as their internal domain. So if they use these operating systems, they cannot resolve that internal domain anymore. That was the first part. Now we take a look on DNS service discovery, which builds on top of multicast DNS. While multicast DNS only works link local, this is a technology to discover services on the network, and that works either link local with multicast DNS or it works globally with standard DNS. And it's using the DNS records we all know and love in a quite creative way. It has service types, and the service types look similar to what we know from SRV records. For example, HTTP dot underscore TCP for a web service. So in order to discover a service on a network, the client sends out a query for a pointer record. And for a pointer record for the name service.transport.local, if that is a request for a local network, that is for multicast DNS, or for service.transport.browse domain, where browse domain is by default the local domain of that client. And then, if there is any service of that type, we will get back a list of pointer records, 0 or more, which lists all the names of the services for that service type. And that will look like this. We will get pointer records back with the name instant.service.transport.domain. I will show you some real life examples a little bit later, makes it more clear. And the application then will display the available instance names. For example, if we have multiple Mac machines running here in the network, all running iTunes, you will see then a lot of instances of iTunes sharing music. And these instant names are UTF-8, and that looks quite unfamiliar, especially if you do static service discovery, because then you have to enter that into your zone files. And here we have an entry for a web server with spaces in the name. That works perfectly, but it looks quite unfamiliar. Services can have subtypes. I won't go deeply into that. That is, if you have the same service, but different kind of service, like a password protected iTunes music sharing, then you have subtypes. So once a user has selected an instance for a service, then a DNSSD application will look up the parameters and hostname for the service. So it will ask for an SRV record for the instance name, and it will also ask for one or more TXT records with the instance name, which gives the parameters to the service in multiple key equals value pairs. So here's some real-world examples of the point record. If I ask for underscore HTTP underscore TCP in the domain dns-sd.org, I get these and more back. These are the instant names. So we have as an instant name space star space zero conf dot underscore HTTP underscore TCP dns-sd.org, which is one instance of a web service running on the dns-sd.org website. And then we can request the SRV and TXT records for such a HTTP service, and that will point us to a service record, port 80, web server, on zeroconf.org, and the parse actually is then the parse on the web server. So we can even have a service pointing on not only a web server, but pointing on a specific parse on that web server. Here's some demo. First, I must enable my wireless. This is demo effect. Yeah. Tested it multiple times. Okay, now it looks good. Okay, here I have on my Linux machine, I have a little service discovery applet, and that shows me all the services running here in this RIPE network. For example, a few people running VNC or remote frame buffer, or websites, and I have created some DNSSD entries for the RIPE DNS working group, for example, in there. So what I want to show you here is I'm connecting to my PowerBook, which is down there somewhere. And I don't need to know the IP address or so. I just find the machine and that it's having VNC running. And this is now my Mac machine, and I have the Safari browser there, and I can click on Bonjour, which is the Apple name of DNS service discovery, and then I see all the web server pages being published here by service discovery in this network, and we see a printer machine with a web service. We see three RIPE 55 pages that I have set up, so I can just choose one of this. And it will then resolve to the SRV record and will display the web page correctly in there, together with the parse that is specified in there. So, that is a real life request for a list, or this is not very visible. Okay, can you see it now? I'm asked for, with Dick, I'm asked for the pointer records for underscore HTTP underscore TCP dot local to the multicast address. And here I see the entries for the RIPE 55 websites. And in the additional section, I see already the SRV records and TXT records for that. And that gives me the list of the parameters for the web server and the PaaS, for example, or for other services, we have other parameters in there. The right meetings are quite a good playground for DNS SD and multicast DNS because there are so many Apple laptops around here and even some Linux machines running that. So there are two protocol enhancements that need changes in a real web DNS server, which is the DNS update list and DNS long-lived queries that, as far to my knowledge, haven't been implemented in any DNS server so far. At least not a mainstream DNS server, so I haven't been able to test that, and I don't see that being happening at our client network, so I won't dive into that. Where do we see multicast DNS and DNS SD in the wild? It has been in macOS 10 since 10.2. It is also nowadays in almost all Linux distribution. There is an implementation for Windows, but it must be downloaded by Apple, and most users don't know that that exists, so we don't see that on Windows so often. The implementation, both the Apple implementation and the Linux implementation, which is called Avahi, are available as open source, and there's language bindings for almost all programming languages available. So what do we see as potential operational issues here? That DNS admins creating wrong static DNS SD entries. I've already seen that. So people try around, especially the people with a lot of time but not enough knowledge. They try to play around with that and create wrong entries. And also these DNS SD clients can auto-register. And of course, it's not good to have a DNS update running just on without security or without T6 security. Some people do that, and this might cause trouble, but that have to be seen if that is really an issue in the wild. And how about DNS bandwidth server load? I will check that over the next 12 months to see if that is an issue somewhere. Because nowadays I really see in almost all enterprise networks some DNS SD traffic and multicast DNS traffic, but most administrators don't know about that. They have that in their network. So the next protocol I would like to talk about is the link local name resolution or multicast name resolution. And that is very, very similar to multicast DNS. It's just from Microsoft, not from Apple. It has also its own cache, and it works on port 5355. And there's actually an RFC for that. It's an informal RFC. And it's now enabled in Vista and Longhorn. So we slowly see that coming into the networks, and will probably over the next year will surpass the Apple multicast DNS traffic in the networks, because even slowly but surely Vista machines are deployed in enterprise networks and they have that enabled by default. So the machines start using that protocol even if the users and administrators don't know that that exists. And it has very similar functions to multicast DNS, but it's different. It's using different multicast addresses. The packages are similar, but they are not identical to classic DNS packages. So with multicast DNS, we really can use Dig and we can use Wireshark to look on the packages. But with link local multicast name resolution, that is not possible anymore because the package format is different. It's similar to DNS, but it's different. So existing tools cannot be used. The collision detection is almost identical to multicast DNS. So a machine gets its name, sends that out to the network, asking for that. If there's no one responding, we think that that name is unique. The difference here is that if the host name is not unique, instead of appending a number to the name, the link local multicast just waits for 15 minutes and then tries again. So it will not change its own name. And also it uses the .local domain, so the same issues apply here, that the classic DNS domain .local is hidden. So how it works, Bob tries to connect to Bill. So Bill sends a multicast to all machines, and now Bill is answering within unicast. So that's a bigger difference. In multicast DNS, Bill will respond with a multicast entry or response, so everyone can listen to that and can learn from that. Here, Bill is sending just a unicast answer back, so only Bob will learn that Bill has this IP address. Also, link local multicast name resolution only works for names and IP addresses, not for services. So operational issues, it's quite the same as multicast DNS. There can be applications sending these queries to classic DNS because of some programming errors in the software, and the .local is hidden. So I think I'm out of time.
Yes, unfortunately, we are running into a break already.
Okay, so this is also, this is maybe we see that in 5 years because that's very far away. So I might do that next time.
Okay, thank you very much. Sorry for the lack of time.
Yeah, maybe two questions or so, or
one or two questions, and there was. If they're around, they're not. There's Patrick wanting to make a 15-second announcement. Until he's running to.
Okay, maybe it's even shorter. I just want to mention that the internet community in Sweden, and hopefully also regulator, and maybe even the Swedish government will sign a note similar to the one Ripe sent in that we will hand over to ICANN next week about signing the rezone.
And there's one other thing I actually forgot to ask the working group, and whether or not there's a sign-off on the way the task force is actually going to continue. And I'll take the answer is yes. So. And thanks. I did already do that.
I hope this was interesting. Okay.
Yes, you can have coffee now.